Susan had never donned quite so bourgeois a garment as Thursday night's Christian Lacroix. In college, just 5 years gone, she'd have abhorred it. But now, being honest, she fucking adored it. The shoulders, the bodice, insane retro poof. Where, once an indictment, now good calming proof. She'd no longer be tarred by the words, shame or greed, tossed about by the meek. No. Now Susan was freed. If she wanted to spend half the whole day adorning herself, well, what of it? The American morning had dawned. At Oberlin, stuff she'd feigned being above had turned into all that she most dearly loved. And conversely, stuff she might actively seek now repelled her as subpar, too lenient, and weak. Out was group therapy. Adieu, agoraphobics. In was massage, silver palate, aerobics. Innermost was a Susan improved and untrammeled, sleeker and diamond bright, sharp and enameled. She happily ate poisonous white flour pasta, whereas all those ultimate frisbee white rastas didn't seem sexy and free anymore. And frankly, the U.S. and El Salvador, or out of it, truly she'd largely lost track and hadn't the patience to find her way back. Indeed, all frail aspects of the human condition now just turned her stomach. Once hated ambition awakened her senses like rarest perfume. It could render her weak-kneed across a large room. And it was all large rooms lately, all beautifully appointed, and Susan had somehow been specially anointed to stand in them prettily, playing her part, the girl at the nexus of commerce and art. Her father was glad to augment the small salary she made as factotum at the Nani Cash Gallery. Nani was in the news 7 months back when she'd ended a group show by handing out crack. Let's turn this new vice into something convivial. The chief of police called her clueless and trivial. Susan adored her and worshipped her style, loved her pronouncements of perfect and vile, loved the sheer whim, the madcap willy-nilliness, how deeply seriously Nani took her own silliness. Though she'd have loved Hitler, if forced to confess, if he had seen fit to have bought her that dress. The opening demands it, Nani said on their spree, and spray can bloody well pay, thanks to me. There was bourbon in hypos, doled out by chic nurses, in truth, white-clad models, Ostra beggars' purses. The waiters were done up like Jean Genet felons, brush cuts, fake shiners, with asses like melons, and serving as Boswells to Nani's new caper, scribes from East Village Eye, FMR, paper. Nani barked orders in Urdu and Khoza, and with a ragazzi, servite qualcosa, came the flush that rose when her blood started to sing from a room where the energy gets into swing. Look at this shit, she thought. Pure onanism. Ransom note lettering, sequins and jism. Neiman impasto with touches of Basquiat, smoke, sizzle, bells, whistles, all of it diddly squat. Nani'd built him a name by dint of sheer will, a bluff that distracted from his lack of skill, despite what collectors seemed willing to pay. Spray can 3,000 had nothing to say. Nathan was due as the evening wound down. They'd rented a car for a week out of town. Josh was in Greenwich, and seeing his mom, they'd stop, pick him up, then continue right on. With luck, they would reach the Cape not long past 1. A week on the ocean had sounded like fun. But when the foreboding that started to loom, when Susan saw Nate standing there across the room, clad in the uniform he'd worn since Ohio. Birkenstocks, drawstring pants, think Putumayo. With no small remorse, she thought, he and his mess better not come near this fabulous dress. Ah, wither love's ardor, whose heat used to scorch her. Now his mere face can assail her like torture. And being alone with him renders her frantic. It makes her a hectoring shrew, a pedantic wet blanket. Although it is also true, in her defense, that Nate can be maddeningly oafish and dense. Who chips a mug without knowing it, or doesn't see that they've just spilt some milk on the floor? And once pointed out, he goes all lotus, positiony, saying mildly, "Wow, I didn't notice." She didn't want some belching, farting, or toga-clad frat boy, but frankly, the wheat germ, the yoga, seemed ersatz, some also-ran version of mellow, this go-with-the-flow, unassailable fellow. She just didn't buy Nathan's pressure-wrought grace, and wanted sometimes just to slap that sweet face. Now, day three in Wellfleet, they've lost all their power, which means no hot water, no lights, and cold showers. And all Nathan does is repeat, "This is cozy." She thinks that perhaps she'll just get up and mosey to where he is sitting to give him a smack. Maybe the blow would do something to crack this passive-aggressive facade for his shirking. Just going downstairs to get things back to working. Or maybe, she thinks, I'll just fuck your best friend. Now something like that might just bring to an end this constant pretending that everything's fine. Maybe then you might evidence some sort of spine. A thunderstorm could be heard off in the distance. Susan had offered Josh any assistance. "Sure," Josh replied. "You can come hold the ladder." Nathan kept reading, which just made her madder. And then madder still when he hadn't detected her tone, which was heavily sarcasm-inflected. "Need anything up here, Nate, before we're done?" "No, that's okay," Nathan replied. "You guys have fun." "We will." Her smile had a slight rodentine tightness. Nathan went back to his unbearable lightness of being, that summer's one Derriger book, and lost in the story, did not even look up from the page for an hour or more when the others came through the basement stairs door. "You were gone for a while. Must have got a lot done." "Oh, we did," Susan said, squinting, as the lights all surged on. Take Posners of Great Neck, the falls at Niagara, and throw in that white marble tomb that's in Agra. Now, if you compared the three places, you might think the Taj and Niagara were hiding their light. At Posner's, the subtle, subdued, and hermetic had no part to play. The Rococo aesthetic, an empire Art Deco chinoiserie garble of crystal and frescoes and gilt and, yes, marble, a maximal, turbocharged, top-drawer milieu, appealed to a moneyed crowd of locals who insisted on only the toppest of drawers, weddings befitting a Louis XIV, Venetian palazzo floors pounded by horrors, cut velvet trapes framing chopped liver torres, ceilings adorned with Tiepolo clouds, vaulted above the dressed to the nine crowds, who gave off their own light with such glinting frequency. Good thing one need not kill creatures for sequins. Nathan, from one of the outlying tables, his feet tangled up in the disc jockey's cables, surveyed the room as unseen as a ghost, while he mulled over what he might say for his toast. That the couple had asked him for his benediction seemed at odds with them parking him here by the kitchen. His invite was late, a forgotten addendum. For Nate there could be no more clear referendum that he need but endure through this evening, and then he would likely not see Josh and Susan again. That he had said yes was still a surprise, and not just to him. It was there in the eyes of the guests who had seen a barrage and drew near, and then covered their shock with a, "Nathan, you're here." And then silence. They had nothing to say beyond that. A few of the braver souls lingered to chat. They all knew it was neither a secret nor mystery that he and the couple had quite not history. Their bonds were a tangle of friendship and sex. Josh, his best pal once, and Susan, his ex. For a while, he could hardly go out in the city without being a punchline or object of pity. Poor Nathan had virtually become his real name, and so he showed up just to show he was game. His shirt had been ironed, his belt brightly buckled, a shine on his shoes, a well-turned-out cuckold. Susan's sister was speaking, a princess in peach. "Hello, I am Minzy, and this is my speech. Susan, you are the best sister, plus you've always had great comic timing, so I know you won't hold it against me when I do my specialty and make my toast in rhyming. You've always been a terrific runner, even though it made your shoes damp, especially when you were impersonating Mrs. Zoltek from Tomatora when we were at camp. Josh, we have become the best of friends, and I'm so happy now I'm your sister, but when we go out together, let's try not to get blisters." Nathan's mind wandered as Mindy meandered. The effort he'd squandered, if this was the standard, seemed hours badly wasted, until he'd recalled that, time notwithstanding, he'd nothing at all. He'd pored over Bartlett's for couplets to filch. He'd stayed up till three and still come up with zilch. Except for instructions, he'd underscored twice, just two words in length, and those words were, "Be nice." Too often he'd noticed emotions betray us, and reason departs once we're up on the dais. He'd witnessed uncomfortable moments where others had lost their way quickly, where sisters and brothers had gotten too prickly and peppered their babbling with stories of benders or lesbian dabbling, or spot-on impressions of mothers-in-law, which, true, Nathan thought, always garnered guffaws, but the price seemed too high, with the laugh seldom cloaking, hostility masquerading as joking. No, he'd swallow his rage and bank all his fire. He knew that in his case, the bar was set higher. He'd have to be careful and hide what his heart meant. Disingenuous malice was Susan's department. They'd be hungry for blood, even though they had supped. Folks were just waiting for him to erupt in tears or some other unsightly reaction, and Nathan would not give them that satisfaction. Though Susan a slattern and Josh was a lout, at least Nathan knew what he'd not talk about. "I won't wish them divorce, that they wither and sicken, or tonight that they choke on their salmon or chicken. I'll stay mum on that time when the cottage lost power in that storm on the Cape and they left for an hour, and they thought it was just the cleverest ruse to pretend it took that long to switch out the fuse. Or that time you advised me with so much insistence that I should be granting poor Susan more distance. that the worst I could do was to hamper and crowd her, that if she felt stifled, she'd just take a powder, that a plant needs its space just as much as its water, and above all, not give her the ring that I'd bought her, which in retrospect only elicits a gosh. I hardly deserved a friend like you, Josh. No, I won't air that laundry or make myself foolish to satisfy appetites venal and ghoulish. I will not be the blot on this hellish affair. And with that, Nathan pushed out and rose from his chair. And just by the tapping of knife against crystal, all eyes turned his way, like he'd fired off a pistol. Joshua, Susan, dear family and friends, a few words, if you will, before everything ends, and you skip out of here to begin your new life as happily married husband and wife. You've promised to honor, to love, and obey. We've sipped our champagne and been cleansed with sorbet, all in endorsement of your, hers, and hisdom. So let me add my 2 cents worth of wisdom. Herewith, as a coda to this evening historical, I just thought I'd tell you this tale allegorical. I was racking my brain sitting here at this table until I remembered this suitable fable. Each reptilian hero, each animal squeal, serves a purpose, you see, because they reveal a truth about life even as they distort us. So here is the tale of the scorpion and tortoise. The scorpion was hamstrung, his tail all a-quiver. Just how would he manage to get across the river? The water's so deep, he observed with a sigh, which pricked at the ears of the tortoise nearby. Well, why don't you swim? Asked the slow-moving fellow. Unless you're afraid, is that it? You yellow? That's rude, said the scorpion. And I'm not afraid so much as unable. It's not how I'm made. Oh, forgive me. I didn't mean to be glib when I said that. I figured you were an amphibian. The error was one of misclassification. I mistakenly figured you for a crustacean. No offense taken, the scorpion replied. But how about you help me to reach the far side? You swim like a dream. You have what I lack. What say you take me across on your back? I'm really not sure that's the best thing to do, said the tortoise, now that I see that it's you. You're the scorpion and, how can I say this, just, well, I don't know I feel safe with you riding my shell. You've a less than ideal reputation proceeding. There's talk of your victims all poisoned and bleeding. That fact by itself should be reason sufficient. I mean, what do you take me for? Mentally deficient? I hear what you're saying. But what would that prove? We'd both drown, so tell me, how would that behoove me to basically die at my very own hand when all I desire is to be on dry land? The tortoise considered the scorpion's defense. When he gave it some thought, it made perfect sense. The niggling voice in his mind he ignored, and he swam to the bank and called out, "Climb aboard." The tortoise was wrong to ignore all his doubts, because in the end, friends, our true selves will out. The merest of moments from when they set sail, the scorpion lashed out with his venomous tail. The tortoise, too late, understood that he'd blundered, when he felt his flesh stabbed and his carapace sundered. As he fought for his life, he said, "Please tell me why you've done this. for now we will surely both die. I don't know, cried the scorpion. You never should trust a creature like me, because poison I must. I'd claim some remorse, or at least some compunction. I simply can't help it. My form is my function. You thought I'd behave like my cousin, the crab, but unlike him, it is but my nature to stab. The tortoise expired with one final quiver, and then both of them sank, swallowed up by the river. Nathan paused, cleared his throat, took a sip of his drink. He needed those extra few seconds to think. The room had gone frosty. The tension was growing. Folks wondered precisely where Nathan was going. The prospects of skirting fiasco seemed dim, but what he said next surprised even him. So, what can we learn from their watery ends? Is there some lesson on how to be friends? I think what it means is that central to living, a life that is good is a life that's forgiving. We're creatures of contact, regardless of whether to kiss or to wound. We still must come together. Like in Annie Hall, we endure twists and torsions for food we don't like, and in such tiny portions. But like hating a food but still asking for more, it beats staying dry but so lonely on shore. So we make ourselves open, while knowing full well it's essentially saying, please, come pierce my shell. So, please, let's all raise up our glasses of wine. And I'll finish this toast with these words that aren't mine. Yet each man kills the thing he loves. By each let this be heard. Some do it with a bitter look, some with a flattering word. The coward does it with a kiss, the brave man with a sword. Where first it seemed that Nathan had his old resentments cleanly hurtled, the air now held the mildest scent of something sweet gone meanly curdled. The thorough ambiguity held guests in states of mild confusion. No one raised their eyes, lest they met glance be taken for collusion. Silence doesn't paint the depth of quiet in that room. There was no clinking stemware toasting to the bride or groom. You could have heard a petal as it landed on the floor. And in that quiet, Nathan turned and walked right out the door. The urinal's wall was the king and his court, a work done in porcelain, precisely the sort of tableau of gentility at Le Petit Trianon, a cast of nobility designed for the peeing on. Nate turned his gaze as he hosed down the scene. It seemed an especially brutish and mean treatment of all the Baroque figures in it. Such unlucky placement. Poor girl at her spinet. He needed the spit stop before he took off to go catch his train when he heard a slight cough. There, twisting a swan's head in gold for hot water, was Lou, who had bankrolled this day for his daughter. Lou had scared Nathan for all of the years he was with Susan, and now the sum of his fears was here. Now the chickens had come home to land. The man of the hour, with his schwanz in his hand. Nathan started to say that he knew how he blew it, and how he was sorry, but Lou beat him to it. Lou, who was blunt, some said boorish, and rich, but a mensch, David Hart said. My Susie's a bitch. You'd think that today I'd be proud, that I'd quell, but I followed you out here just so I could tell you. She told her friends she would be able to get you to come give a toast. It's a monstrous bet. Made all the more awful that her day of joy was still incomplete, and abusing a boy in a trick was the thing that she wanted above all else. It's the mark of a girl who can't love. Ugh, Nathan, this day is a stroke of bad luck. You cast in this play and then played for a schmuck. And think of it this way, she'll wake up tomorrow and still be unhappy. And that is my sorrow. Lou turned off the swan's head, once more checked his tie. He held his arm out and said, this is goodbye. He shook Nathan's hand and then made for the door, where he paused and he turned to say just one thing more. That toast, if you give it again, but you won't. Remember, Nate, turtles swim, tortoises don't.